Wow. Thanks everyone for joining us this evening. We've got a tremendous event lined up, really, really tremendous. For the first half of the evening, I'll be talking to Kieran Andreo. He's an incredibly courageous person. He just spent, I think, the best part of a month at sea. He was briefly in detention in the Negev desert at the leisure of Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government. There's a really powerful statistic I've been talking about recently when it comes to Gaza, when it comes to Palestine, because very often in our line of work, you meet people, members of the public or people in the media or even politics, and they say, why is this so important? Why do you care so much about this but not XYZ conflicts? And sometimes that's a fair question, but it really does neglect the singular nature of what's happened in Gaza over the last 2 years. So here is a statistic that really sticks in my mind anyway. The Gaza Strip is more or less the same size as the Isle of Wight. And yet, in terms of munitions by weight, it's been subject to more than Dresden, Hamburg, and London combined over the whole of the Second World War. More munitions by weight on this tiny strip of land with 2.5 million people than those three very large cities over a period of 6 years of conflict. Of course, the bombings didn't last that long. There's another statistic, though, in this book, which is perhaps even more terrifying. In Ukraine, after 2 years of conflict, there are around 30 cases of child amputees. 30 too many, of course. That's after 2 years. In Gaza, there were 1,000 cases of child amputation in 2 months. And that really highlights the double standard when it comes to the West, how we cover conflicts, how they matter to people, who they matter to. And that was just one data point from this extraordinary book we're talking about today. Now, 50% of the profits from tonight's event go to medical aid for Palestinians. I think one of the most important organizations in the world right now, so we're very proud that we can do that. But as good as that is the fact that all the proceeds from this book, all of the proceeds of this book, go to UNRWA. Welcome, Kieran. Very happy you're back in one piece. Come on stage.
Thanks very much.
How are you reacclimatizing back to normality? What's it like to be back in the UK after what you went through?
Well, so I haven't stopped, really. I haven't stopped doing things. And the reason I haven't is there were still people in Israeli prisons until, I think, today. I think the last person has been released today. And so it was imperative to keep up the media stuff, to keep banging the drum as loudly as possible in order to get people released as much as anything else. But that's given me a handy excuse to not stop and process things. So who knows? Maybe I'll crash and burn. But right now I feel okay. I genuinely feel okay. And I said this multiple times over the past few days, but I really mean it. Everybody that has shown kindness or love and support, it means a great deal to me and to everybody that was on the flotilla. I know people who aren't as fortunate as I am who are on the flotilla, people who don't have family that supports them in what they did, don't have communities that understand what they were doing in the first place on the flotilla and treat them like pariahs as a result. And that, I cannot begin to imagine how difficult that must be. So I'm very lucky, and it's really good to almost see you all. The lights are very bright, but it's very good to be here with you all.
So some of the people here might not know the nautical specifics of just how close you got to Gaza.
Mm.
Because we were covering it the night before, or the night of, the morning of, when you guys were effectively kidnapped by the Israeli state. And there was a brief moment, it seemed, where you had hundreds of people at sea in all these tiny vessels, and you were less than 45 nautical miles from the shores of Gaza, which would have been absolutely extraordinary if even several of you had got through with aid. Was there a moment where, amongst yourselves, you were talking about the possibility of evading capture, evading the IDF?
Well, so first of all, my boat got 70 nautical miles. I didn't know any of this, so I'm just going to very quickly say 12 nautical miles is territorial waters. So anything outside of that is international waters. So any interception outside of 12 nautical miles away from a coast is illegal. It's a kidnapping, as you say, Aaron, more properly described as a kidnapping. My boat got 70 nautical miles because it was the third largest boat, and the IDF clearly strategized to take out the lead boat first, then the second largest boat, and then the third largest boat, and then progress downwards like that. So we got intercepted very early, which meant that my phone went into the water very early, which meant that we were completely cut off from the outside world very early on. The first thing that the IDF did when they got on our boats was they were shouting, "Starlink, Starlink, where are the Starlinks?" And then they smashed up the Starlinks, the system that we were using so that we could remain connected to the internet and communicate with the world. They cut the camera straight away. So that was the first thing they did. All our phones were in the water, so there was no way of knowing what was going on. I was then told, you know, jump forward 2-3 days later, we're back. People are trying to catch me up on everything that happened. And I'm told that several boats got to 25 nautical miles out or 30 nautical miles out. But I have to say, I personally, and maybe I shouldn't admit this, I never thought we would get to Gaza. I genuinely never thought we would get to Gaza because I thought it was pretty obvious that the IDF knew that if they allowed us to get to Gaza, then their illegal genocidal siege was breached, and that that would potentially open a humanitarian corridor in the sea, which would then allow for more aid to go in, a conduit for international humanitarians and humanitarian aid. I didn't think the IDF would allow that, but, and maybe we can get onto some of the other significant wins around the flotilla in a bit. I still thought that it was a worthwhile mission, whether we managed to get the aid there or not. And to be perfectly honest with you, there was aid on every boat. There was a lot of aid on every boat, but it was never going to be sufficient, anywhere near sufficient to even touch the sides of the need that has been manufactured in Gaza. And so actually, it was kind of, I had to make my peace early on with the high probability that the IDF would intercept us. And then, you know, then we move on to the other strategic political dimensions of the mission, which we can come on to, which I think were very significant and which I do think produced strategic wins and losses for Israel. So I expected it. I was very, very impressed when I heard that some boats got to 30 nautical miles out. And I was kind of quite jealous. I wanted to see Gaza. I wanted to get there more than anything. And you know, even if I say now I expected the IDF to intercept, of course, strategically, you never admit that. Because if you do, then Israeli Hasbara comes out and says, oh, it's all for show anyway, and it's about something else. They don't think they're going to get here. So you never admit that. You prepare for the worst, you hope for the best, and you keep that boat moving forward.
I should say, for anybody from the right-wing press joining us this evening, and I'm pretty damn
sure... I'm too honest, sorry.
There'll absolutely be somebody from the Spectator or the Mail or whatever, but the point is this, if even several vessels did get through, and they were tiny and they had very little aid, like you say, the precedent that would have set would have been extraordinary, and there was a smaller flotilla behind you. There are nation states who want to help, who are presently unable to, who again may have been able to fill that slipstream, NGOs, international third sector organizations, and so on.
Absolutely.
So, I understand it was very unlikely, but it still would have been something quite extraordinary.
And just to say, if there are members of the right-wing press here, I'm only expressing my expectations, what I anticipated. This wasn't formal global submarine flotilla policy. Nobody went around and said, right, guys, don't get your hopes up. We're not going to get there. Everybody planned to get to Gaza. That was absolutely baked into the strategy. My personal expectation was that we would be intercepted. But I understood, and I believe, and I'm happy to convey to all of you, that there were significant political wins. Would you like me to quickly...
Go on. It's kind of important, right?
Okay, first of all, So I'm not sure whether this actually happened, but I'm told that people in Gaza were able to fish because we kept the IDF so busy. And that... So that is of immense value in itself. For people who have been forced via, you know, to the point of starvation or beyond, to be able to fish the waters in their own seas and to eat a good meal or several meals, or for the community or a family or even an individual, to be able to eat because we kept those godforsaken bastards busy, is to me immensely moving, and I found and of tremendous value in itself. But larger, okay, let's look at the larger regional geostrategic stuff. We managed to get three navies to escort the flotilla. Now, nobody has any illusions about Meloni, obviously.
So just to be clear, the navies were?
Italian, Spanish, and Turkish. Nobody has any illusions about the Turkish government or about the Italian government. But it was nonetheless a significant geostrategic form of pushback against Israel. And it was only achieved because of mass organization in Italy, in Spain, not so much in Turkey, but in Italy and in Spain. And we need to, I mean, you know, obviously a genocide has been perpetrated and has been allowed to continue with the consent of governments in the West. And so I suppose it would be very important going forward to try and replicate that kind of mass movement that closes down entire parts of the economy. The trade unions in Italy were instrumental. And because of that activity, there were naval frigates put onto the Mediterranean to protect us. Now, I would like to see that replicated in Gaza, obviously, but it shows that the populations of Europe are paying attention, and it shows that it can be done, that countries can force even neo-fascist governments with close ties to Israel to send their naval vessels out to protect their own citizens. And I think that that is a significant political win. It's not something that Israel was expecting. Israel was expecting that it would be able to bomb our flotilla repeatedly. It did so in Tunisian national waters. Netanyahu's now admitted that after the BBC initially said it was a cigarette. Then they tried to bomb us south of Crete in international waters. Both those things constitute maritime crimes, and both those things constitute crimes against humanity. So the fact that we were able to, you know, international relations is often a very bleak thing, especially for those of us on the left. But the fact that that bottom-up organizing in trade unions and across civil society in Italy and Spain was able to activate a sort of deterrent, a military deterrent against Israel, is a serious and significant step in the right direction. And we need to keep it up.
And for me, I think it really underscores how this game, I don't like to use that word, but for people like Netanyahu, statescraft geopolitics is a game,
yeah,
was being played at multiple levels. So in the streets of places like London or Paris, but also amongst embassies, foreign officials, the British, believe it or not, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is meant to care about British nationals who are kidnapped, you know? And the fact that you had the recognition of the state of Palestine while all this is happening, again, nobody thinks any of this is a game changer. But for me, it does feel like there's a crescendo of disdain and pushback against the Israeli state, the Israeli government, that's kind of impossible to ignore unless you're the most diehard of Zionists. And even then, I think those guys are kind of getting the hint. I want to ask you this. Walk us through what it was like being kidnapped by the IDF at what, 5 in the morning, Eastern Mediterranean time?
Yeah, no, it was earlier for us. For
4 a.m.?
For my boat, it was much earlier. It was about 10 p.m. But some boats were kidnapped at 4 or 5 a.m. But yes, the point still stands. What was it like?
You weren't asleep. Lucky you.
I was. So, it's strange when you prepare for a moment over so many days and weeks, and then it happens. It almost feels like you're watching someone else's experience of something, or it's not really happening. And that theme would continue throughout the whole experience. So we were on the boat. We had high alert that they were in the region, that they were in the area. And as I say, 70 nautical miles out from the coast. So international waters. Bright lights start shining across our boat from all directions. And then we start to see large naval vessels, but just a silhouette, because it's very dark, it's nighttime. And that was really menacing. I mean, they really looked like they should have, like, I don't know, a sort of plodding musical score backing them or something. But they were kind of coming around. It's a bit like sharks or something. And then eventually they pull up right next to the boat. And that's when I said to anybody that was watching the live stream, okay, it's time to throw my phone in the water. And I did. And then about a minute later, just as they were boarding the boat, someone said to me, could you chuck my phone in the water? I forgot to put it. And I was like, okay, you're literally going to get me shot. So I took it and chucked it in the water. Managed to get it in the water without anybody seeing. But very much against protocol. And then they stepped on the boat, you know, seconds after I managed to dispose of the final phone. And it just felt very surreal. I felt extremely serene. I don't know how else to describe it. I felt very calm at that moment. I didn't feel calm throughout the whole experience, but I felt calm at that moment. They got on, I'm not going to do accents, but I'm not. But it felt very stereotypical of an authoritarian army, if I can put it like that. And they were giving us all sorts of strange orders. They were spraying us with skunk water. Did anybody see? Anyway, they were spraying us with skunk water, and they said, if you turn off motor, we turn off water. And we were kind of like, well, we don't really care that much about the water. But anyway, they climbed on board, big machine guns, shotguns, and they kind of just surrounded us. And they all had their faces covered, of course, because they know that in years to come, they're going to be wanted for war crimes. This is the S-13 unit. And the S-13 unit is instrumental, I don't know how else to put it, in the genocide. Absolutely instrumental. And in every single war or massacre that Israel has presided over, the S-13 is pretty instrumental. They're an elite naval unit. Having said that they're an elite naval unit, they spent the entire evening vomiting over the side of the boat. And I said that to my uncle, who's a sailor, the other day, and he said, no, but you shouldn't laugh about that, because all sailors, even if they're experienced, but it was very funny. And I'm just going to stand up to, but they were struggling to, you know, the boat was rocking back and forth, and they were struggling to hold their composure. But they were barking very serious orders at us while they were struggling to stand up. They're having to support each other. Sit down, do not, you know. So anyway, there we were. We all had our hands up because that was part of our training. Nobody, you know, have a go heroes in that situation are not what you want. So we all had our hands up, and we were treating the experience with a kind of gravity that my comic retelling now probably doesn't convey. But, you know, we were kind of, I think, very disciplined.
Well, you were telling people, you were telling your comrades, get your fucking hands up.
And apparently
people were saying, this is, oh my God, there's a Brit in the IDF. Yeah. It's like Kieran.
So I only found this out afterwards.
Revolutionary discipline.
I only found this out afterwards. Some people, as they were climbing on the boat and I was about to chuck my phone away and they were standing there barking orders at us pointing their machine guns. Some people were still like just half asleep, basically. So I said, sorry, guys, can you put your fucking hands up, please? Apparently afterwards, people said, hey, that IDF soldier sounds like he's from Essex.
Wouldn't surprise me.
So
Yeah, which is very...
IDF soldier looks like Thomas Skinner or
very
something.
Very reasonable conclusion.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Half of them are from, not necessarily Essex, but not from the colony. Anyway, so that was that. Then, to speed this up a bit, they then kind of herded us into rooms. I was in a room with 9 people who don't speak English, but it's fine. They herded us into rooms and they guarded our doors with machine guns. And if you needed to go to the toilet, and then they sailed the boat to the port of Ashdod, which is an Israeli port north of Gaza. So, and you know, I know I said at the start, oh, I didn't expect us to get there, but obviously we were all crushed. I mean, I was really, really crushed. And we were all so upset and angry that we were being taken to a place that none of us wanted to go to. We weren't trying to get to the port of Ashdod, obviously. So it was a very intense set of mixed emotions in that kind of 15-hour journey to Ashdod. One final thing on their incompetence. They had to ask one of us how to drive the boat. Genuinely, I'm not making this up. One of them, eventually they came and said, like, you're the captain. And we never admitted who the captain was, by the way, because you never do. Because the captain gets treated more harshly than everybody else, typically speaking. So, but they kind of worked out who was crew, and they yanked one of my friends to the, what do they call it, the wheelhouse, and said, you know, help us. And, you know, she had to help the IDF. Otherwise, we were going to stay stuck for, you know, an indefinite amount of time. And none of us wanted that because it was a soft inception, but they're all on drugs. Well, not all, but many of them are on drugs. The S-13 is notorious for its drug consumption.
What kind of drugs? Amphetamine.
Amphetamine-related based drugs, yeah. And it's very, obviously it sounds glib saying it's depressing. Yeah, I mean, these guys have helped preside over a genocide. But the S-13 unit has a notoriously high substance abuse, a percentage of people abusing substances, basically. And that is, you would assume, because underneath everything, they remain human beings, and committing genocide is not something fundamentally human, or not something that, you know, the psyche can deal with very well. So, yeah. So that's another reason that we were very kind of disciplined, because any small provocation or any jumpiness or anything like that could result in God knows.
So hold on, we've done Carry On Mossad on drugs.
Sorry.
Right. You then spent several days in a prison in the Negev Desert.
They take us to the port of Ashdod. They drag us out. They cable tie our hands. They put us on our knees. They keep us there for several hours. They bring out Ben Gavir.
Wow. So you saw him?
He walked this close to me. I won't say what I wanted to do, but he was that close to me, and my hands were cable tied. We were all face down. It was just, I barely slept for a month. It was one of the most surreal moments of my life, and obviously one of the most stressful as well. But yeah, but the good thing is that they paraded us in front of Ben Gavir, or paraded Ben Gavir in front of us, and they obviously expected us to be cowed into submission, but actually we all started spontaneously shouting Free Palestine, and they didn't know what the fuck to do. So then we got processed and then taken, I say processed, we'd fast tracked through various security systems and then taken on a bus 2 hours away from the port of Ashdod to a prison in the Negev Desert. And maybe I'll hand back to you there. Do you want me to keep talking about that experience?
Yeah, we're going to go to questions in 10 minutes. So I think that's a good place to conclude.
Okay. So we get there. Oh, there's so much to say about it. But anyway, basically we get there and Ben Gavir follows us there. And I didn't realize this until afterwards. He actually went to individual cells and told people that they were terrorists and that they were now locked in a terror prison. And one thing he said was true, which is that it's a prison that Israel built. Actually, it dates back to the 50s. Yeah, the late 50s. But it's been developed over time. And its main raison d'etre, its main purpose, function, has been to incarcerate what Israel designates as Palestinian terrorists. Now, of course, you know, many of them are innocent individuals. And one of them, I worked out the following day, had been my own brother, had been incarcerated in that prison several years before and tortured there. And I didn't really figure this out until the following day, because I didn't know where we were. So let me just go back to the chronology. We were chucked in, we were processed, we were stripped, we were put in a cage. There was about 100 people. All of these people were global Samud flotilla people, by the way. The whole prison had been cleared of Palestinians.
There's over 400 of you, right?
Yeah, there's over 400 of us. And they separated us by gender. So I get there, it's 5 a.m, it's just getting light. I've just been transported on the bus. My hand, I don't like to whinge about these things because obviously, you know, it shouldn't even really bear repeating, but it does. Palestinian prisoners are treated infinitely worse, and they're not now back in London speaking to a lovely crowd of people. But I was genuinely worried for a while that my fingers were going to drop off because they had cable tied my hands so tightly together, and I had to keep trying to move, and other people on my prison bus were helping me because mine was tighter than theirs. Anyway, we get to the prison in the Negev Desert. Suddenly we're there, and there's 100 people in this cage, this brightly illuminated cage. It was incredibly surreal. We get herded into the cage, and then we get processed, so we get stripped. And we get put in our prison smocks, and we get taken
to... So other people can see you naked?
No, we were taken behind a curtain. Admittedly, we were taken behind a curtain. And then we were put in our prison clothes. And then off we went to our cells. And I was, you know, the one... And I do want to emphasize this, because it's not all entirely hopeless or... You know, a story about the evils of the state of Israel. It is, fundamentally. But it's, I guess, also a story about solidarity and the empowerment that comes through solidarity. Because when we arrived, we were really shit scared. We were. Everybody was. And everybody was quiet and everybody was cowed. People who had been big characters on the boats and so on. Everybody looked absolutely drained. We didn't know what was going to happen. You know, we thought... Are we here for years and years? That's what Ben-Gavir was telling everybody. And then we go to our prison cell, and the guards are obviously complete thugs. And they come to our prison cell and they start smashing on the doors. We've just been processed. We've just been put in our cells. Nobody had really slept for days. And they start bashing on the doors and they start saying, stand up, stand up. And we stand up, and then they turn the lights on. They laugh at us. They turn the lights off. We go back to sleep, repeat, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat.
How many times?
10 times over the next 3 hours, 4 hours. You lose sense of time because it's dark in the cell, right? You can just about see the sun through the bars when it comes up, but that's it. But it's fundamentally, it's like there's no time in those prison cells.
And was that those guys doing it carte blanche because they wanted to do something and they were bored? Or do you think there's actually a protocol almost in terms of soft torture against people like yourselves?
Yeah, I mean, what they did for us was a very weak version, very weak, of strategies and tactics that they practiced on Palestinians for decades. And so, yeah, it was clearly, they were reading from a handbook.
That was your sense of how they were?
Yeah. And it's consistent with stuff that my brothers told my family about the way they behave. But as I say, a much weaker edition, if you like. But what they do is, you know, the Israelis love psychological warfare, right? We know that. In all sorts of magnitudes, large and small. And they love their psychological warfare with Palestinian prisoners. Much more, as I say, severe than we got. But yeah, waking people up, sleep deprivation... They would walk along every 5-10 minutes and shout a name, the name of someone who isn't there, But, you know, so where is Mohammed Abu Bakr? They kept saying, I remember, wake up, and they were smashing on our doors saying, are you Mohammed Abu Bakr? Where is Mohammed Abu Bakr? And then they'd go away, and then they'd come back and do it 10 minutes later when you drifted off to sleep again. And then they would get the dogs barking. So there was a dog kennel just round the corner. They would set the dogs off so that we could hear the dogs barking ferociously. And then they would, you know, settle them down, and then they'd do it an hour later, and every hour like clockwork. And it's just, that's very typical of what they do. So that was going on. And at first, for the first few hours, we were very, very scared. I mean, we were just kind of being very pliant and you know, doing whatever they wanted us to do. And then something really started to shift, actually. Now, again, I say this with a strong caveat. Palestinian, we were able to do this because I'm half Palestinian, but I have passport privilege. I've got a British passport. I've got a European name, and my mum is European. So, you know, it's not the same as if you're a row of Palestinian prisoners in cells. But we were able to shift the power dynamic throughout the day, because at first we were very cowed and we were sort of doing whatever they asked us to do. By the end of the day, we were really swearing in their faces, telling them that they're fuckers, and, you know, it was kind of beautiful to behold. And you know, there were loads of, because it was separated by gender, so there were loads of Muslim guys in the cells nearby, and they started doing the call to prayer in the cells, and you can imagine that the guards didn't like that very much, and they kept banging and saying, shut up, and they wouldn't shut up, they got louder and louder. And we sang, I don't know, it's kind of embarrassing to admit this. We sang You'll Never Walk Alone, and it was very rousing. And you know, they were threatening to pepper spray us through the bars, and the more they did that, the louder we got. And yeah, you know, so again, we have power on our side because of our passports, but it was nonetheless, in the space of like 12 hours, 15 hours, we really managed to turn the tables on them. We were still locked in cages, but we managed to turn the psychological power dynamic against them.
I mean, it is still incredibly brave because, like you say, that could be the next 6 months of your life, the next 6 years of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think many people have much trust in the due process and fair play of the Israeli prison system.
Yeah.
And you can get lost.
That's true.
Quickly, before we go to questions, how do you feel that the Foreign Office looked after you?
I'm ever so grateful. No, they
were they worried about you? Did they make it? Because obviously you're in the media, you know, you've got a spotlight on you, and that's not always the case with people who are picked up by the Israelis.
No, I'm glad that you asked this, Aaron, because it does highlight something important. First of all, no, I'm not impressed with the Foreign Office and the way that they dealt with it, but that is a lightning rod for something else, which I think is illuminating in itself, important in itself. And okay, so every one of us got visited by a consular general, or we had the offer of a consular general, British, Italian. I was sharing a cell with Brazilians, Italians, US citizens. And every single person that saw their consular general told the same story, which is that their consular general was shit scared of the Israeli prison guards and of the Israelis. And draw from that what you will, or conclude from that what you will, but I just found that so fucking depressing. I just thought, you absolute spineless bastards. And it's of a piece with the way that the world treats Israel generally, you know. And yeah, so I'm glad you asked it. No, they were shaking while they were taking notes. They were shaking, and they were going, I have to say this quietly, but you know, we can have a debrief when you get back to England if you want. It's not like the movies.
You didn't have MI6 going, Kieran.
No.
Some handsome guy with a martini.
No, it's really not. But you know, on a serious note, I had a guy with me who was 75. He's a British guy, 72 actually, I think. But he was very frail. And he had the same stories as me, as everybody. No medicine. He had a serious heart condition induced by age. No water in his cell, no fucking toilet paper. It was really, and he was frail, and he was shaking, and it was boiling hot. It was the middle of the desert. And it was so depressing to see. And the consul general was too frightened to even raise this with the Israelis. He just took notes and said, I'll tell your family and I'll make sure that this gets back.
By the way, this guy was ex-RAF, right?
Yes. Yes.
If you're not going to do it for people like that, then who are you?
Yeah.
Well, we know they're not going to do it for anybody.
Yeah.
Let's take some quick questions for the best part of 15 minutes.
Hi there. So my name is Sabri. I just have a quick question about, so obviously you will all encounter different soldiers during the time, but did you ever communicate either after, during, like what the sentiment or the feeling or the vibe, for lack of a better word, of the soldier war? Is it confident? Is it lack of confidence? Is it like, what is it? Because obviously committing a genocide and having the backing of a state and the backing of a superpower, one can only imagine that backs you in the large grand scheme of things, but is each individual must have some shortcomings or whatever it may be. So what can you say about that?
Next question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, will you go back, and how will your kind of political activism around Gaza change, especially in the wake of the ceasefire?
Should we take one more?
One more, yeah.
When you said that the mood shifted after so many hours of being sort of compliant, what do you think was sort of the catalyst for that shift? Was it something that you'd all thought about, discussed before, or was it just that sort of, fuck it, I don't give a damn anymore?
So first question, were they nervous? Were they jittery? Were they confident? I got the sense, and it's hard to know whether I'm just reading my own hopes and dreams into an objective reality, but I think that they were genuinely lacking in confidence, and I think that they genuinely were nervous. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So first of all, we went the whole night locked in this little room when the S-13 unit were driving us to Ashdod. And at one point, I kind of shifted so that my eye line was going down the corridor and I could see them on the upper deck of the boat. And after a while, I noticed that one of them wasn't wearing their mask. And he was chatting away and joking away with his colleagues. And then we locked eyes. And as soon as we did, he very nervously pulled his mask back up over his face. Now, I'm not saying that he thought, you know, oh, this guy's going to shop me in 2 years' time or something when I'm trying to go to a trance festival in India or wherever. But there was serious nervous, you know, I can, to the extent that all of us can, I know expressions when they're very clear. And he was genuinely shifty and sheepish and nervous and quickly pulled the thing over his face. And now, that's protocol. They should have their faces covered. But their lack of professionalism meant that he didn't for a moment. But I think that says something. I think that they are nervous. They know. And then when I was being processed through the port of Ashdod, I got chatting to a couple of the police officers that were escorting me, and you know, they were very pissed off with us. So they were talking quite freely to me, and they said on multiple occasions, why does everybody hate us? They genuinely don't understand why. And then later, you know, and this is sort of just riffing on your question. It's not exactly, but it is related, it's adjacent. I think it's relevant. In the prison, one of the guys in my cell was Norwegian, and they 5 prison guards didn't know what Norwegian or Norway was or Norwegian was. And they kept saying, do you speak French? I mean, what is Norway? Is it France? And so, you know, again, I'm not, but it's a very, it's becoming an increasingly sclerotic society, an isolated society, a bit like the stereotypes we have of the US. And, you know, that people, they don't know about the rest of the world. But it's more extreme in Israel. I think it's more extreme. I mean, you know, the US, for all of its million faults, at least it produced Miles Davis. I don't see Israel doing anything like that. I think it's turning more and more inwards. And it's the people that I encountered were ordinary Israelis, police officers, you know, people, working class Israelis. They don't have a clue about the outside world. And that's obviously by design of the political and media elites. They don't understand why the world hates them. They still think Israel's the best country in the world. And none of that screams confidence to me. Like, they might seem like they have confidence when you're interacting with them on a superficial level, but it's a byproduct of deep structural concern, I think, for the future.
Mm. Also, I was just going to say, I think last year there was net emigration out of Israel for the first time in a while. I think it was quite significant. And it came to mind when I saw an Israeli figure or spokesperson say, you know, a country's in trouble when Jews start leaving. It's like, well, that's happening to Israel. So,
right. Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean?
Exactly.
It hardly bodes well in terms of an optimistic vision for the future. Exactly. So the second question,
what will I do now that I'm back?
Will you go back to Gaza?
It's too early to say. I don't know if I'll go back on the flotilla, but I may. I might do. I think that I'll need quite a bit of time if I'm going to do that. To be honest with you, I don't think that. I think there's plans for one more flotilla before the end of the year, but I think winter tends not to be the time that people go on flotillas. Obviously, there's a need in Gaza all year round, so that maybe sounds a bit glib, but they also have to take safeguarding and safety into account, right? The guys that organize it. It's no benefit to anybody if we're kind of lambs to the slaughter or overly subject to the weather and so on. So I don't know if I will go back on the flotilla. Maybe I will. What I can say is it has really energized me. I can feel that I want to do as much as I can possibly do all the time with all of you and with the national and international solidarity groups. And it's really like sharpened my determination. I guess it was there in the first place, otherwise I wouldn't have gone on the flotilla, but it has sharpened it more. It hasn't deterred me in any sense, and I'm absolutely in no way deterred by anything that Israel did to me. So, and if anybody does want to go on flotilla in the future, I encourage you, if that's what you're sure you want to do, but I'm here for you if you want to talk about it and talk about the experience, because you should be well prepared. And then the last question was about the solidarity, the shifting of the power dynamic, am I right? Shifting of the power dynamic in the cells. Okay, there's a very clear answer to this. I shared a cell with an absolutely legendary Celtic fan who was so leery and just absolutely went for the guards really early on. And I'll admit, at first I was like, I didn't say it to him, but I was thinking, shit, like, you know, I'm half Palestinian. They don't seem to know that yet, but I'm in a different category. I need to be a bit, but I really want to speak to him again to tell him how instrumental he was in changing the atmosphere among all of us and shifting the power dynamic. He was really, really leery immediately. And that really encouraged the rest of us to be really, really leery. And it is, as much as anything else, it was a kind of interesting, once you're out of there and you're not worrying about your life anymore, you can look back on it through a kind of anthropological lens. Because I was like, you know, as much as anything else, it was interesting to see how this guy was fearless. And it then encouraged the rest of us to be less fearful, at least. And then that rippled outwards. And before the Israelis knew it, they had an entire row of prisoners telling them that they were Nazis. So there we are.
Don't let the Labour Party hear you say that. You might get thrown out.
I don't think they want to break bread with me anyway.
Yeah, it's probably the least of your problems in the Negev Desert. One more round of applause for this incredible man.